any consequence of the delay, which resulted in oppressive pretrial incarceration, which interfered with the accused's right to minimize anxiety and concern in regard to the accusation, or which created the possibility that the defense will be impaired. On July 29, 1980, by a 2-1 decision, the Fourth Circuit panel found that McDonald's Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial had indeed been infringed upon, and to such an extent that the jury's verdict should be set aside, the sentence of 3 consecutive life terms in prison should be vacated, and the original indictment dismissed. Writing the majority opinion, Justice Francis D. Murnaghan stated that while we cannot and do not assess the correctness of the jury's verdict, and while the required judicial balancing process necessary has been particularly difficult, the vital balancing tips the scales decisively in favor of finding a violation. Murnaghan based this finding in part upon his belief that the 2-year delay between the submission of the final CID report in June of 1972 and the convening of the grand jury in 1974 had been the result of the Justice Department's calloused and lackadaisical attitude. McDonald's claim, in Murnaghan's opinion, clearly met the first 3 criteria as established by the Supreme Court. The vital question was the one concerning prejudice, and here, the trial testimony of Helena Stokely, in Murnaghan's view, provided the definitive answer. He wrote, "Had Stokely testified as it was reasonable to expect she might have, the injury to the government's case would have been incalculably great. The possible reasons why Stokely did not testify are several. But the principal reason she asserted under oath was failure of memory. The government's inexorable delay of over 2 years' duration cannot be eliminated as a potential, indeed a probable, cause of that memory lapse." Though he likened Stokely's memory to a light bulb not screwed tight, blinking on and off, Murnaghan wrote, "Still, the unavoidable principle remains that passage of time generally tends to erase memory," and he found that this substantial proof of prejudice, when combined with a showing of unreasonable delay, constituted a violation of constitutional rights serious enough to warrant dismissal of the charges. While the decision, he wrote, was made more difficult by the terrible crime and by the fact that a jury has found McDonald guilty after a protracted trial, the court could not condone a prosecutorial method of obtaining convictions in violation of the fundamental constitutional rights of future generations. This opinion, in which Justice James M. Sprouse concurred, was dissented from vigorously by Justice Albert V. Bryan, Sr., who wrote, "McDonald's guilt and sanity were established to the satisfaction of the trial jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Nevertheless, this court absolves him forever on this hideous offense, shockingly laying his release exclusively on the failure of the government to prosecute within a shorter time than it did." Conceding that the government's rationale for the 2-year delay prior to the convening of the grand jury warranted disapproval, Judge Bryan contended nonetheless that nothing in the record warrants the assumption that Stokely would have or could have given the testimony the majority would ascribe to her had the government secured its indictment earlier. Stokely herself, in her trial testimony, explains that her inability to recall the pre-dawn events of February 17, 1970 resulted from her consumption, earlier in the evening, of large quantities of drugs. She in no way indicated that time had weakened her recollection. Indeed, the record fully upholds the government's contention that any culpable delay on its part had no discernible effect on Stokely's testimony. It was, however, the majority opinion which had the force of law, and so, by mid-morning of the day the decision was announced, champagne was flowing freely in the emergency room of St. Mary's. Also pleased, though not expressing elation, was Jeffrey McDonald's mother. "All I can say is, thank God that in this land we still have some intelligent persons, somebody who can bring justice out of chaos," she said. "It's been 10 long years, and I'm still angry and frustrated. We've suffered and suffered and suffered. And while I'm joyful, I'm also sorry that there was not a total vindication of his name. 3,000 miles away, Freddy Kassab termed the decision a travesty and said, I'll still stand by what I said 5 years ago. If the courts of this country won't administer justice, I will. The Justice Department announced its intention to ask for a rehearing before the full Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, but on August 22nd, 51 weeks after his conviction, Jeffrey McDonald was released on bail, pending further legal developments. He returned to his condominium at 16052 Mariner Drive, where he found his car and boat and jacuzzi in good working order, and Candy Kramer and his mother waiting faithfully. Even before the brief had been filed with the appeals court, friends of Jeffrey McDonald had hired a private detective from Los Angeles to conduct an investigation into the case. The detective's name was Ted Gunderson. He had spent 28 years with the FBI, having retired as head of the agency's Los Angeles division earlier in 1979, and the walls of his Wilshire Boulevard office were crowded with autographed pictures of such people as Gerald Ford, Johnny Carson, J. Edgar Hoover, Ronald Reagan, Jerry Brown, Walter Matthau, Steve Garvey, Roger Staubach, and John Wayne. Gunderson had begun work immediately, bringing to his task great energy and enthusiasm, and the appeals court decision did not cause the slightest slackening of his pace. As he told the press the day the decision was announced, "We don't want Jeff to be known as a man who was let out on a technicality. We intend to prove his innocence." Gunderson, in fact, accompanied by a female psychic from the Canadian province of Ontario, and working with the cooperation of Prince Edward Beasley, the retired Fayetteville detective, had already made contact with Helena Stokely. On May 1st, the trio had located Stokely in a JCPenney store in Greenville, South Carolina, where she was trying on nurses' uniforms. The psychic had handed Stokely a letter written the night before, in which she said, 5 weeks ago, Jeff McDonald came into my life, and my entire world changed. I met a man full of warmth, love, energy, and life, and I knew that he was innocent and had every right to be cleared. In the letter, the psychic pledged that McDonald's friends would support Stokely in every possible way, both financially and emotionally, if she would only cooperate with them. At the time, Stokely had said, I can't now, I wish I could. By October, however, she had expressed a willingness to come to California and discuss matters further with Gunderson. On October 15th, after spending 5 days in a Southern California motel and having been told by Gunderson that he would help her to resettle in a new location, to find a job, and to start a new life, Stokely signed a statement in which she admitted that she and five friends, Bruce Fowler, Greg Mitchell, Don Harris, Dwight Smith, and Alan Mazarol, all members of a satanic cult, two of them, Fowler and Mitchell, had been questioned, polygraphed, and dismissed as suspects during the 1971 reinvestigation, had entered 544 Castle Drive during the early morning hours of February 17, 1970, and had murdered Jeffrey McDonald's wife and children in order to punish McDonald for its refusal to supply methadone to cult members who were heroin addicts. On December 18th, the Fourth Circuit Court split 5-5 on the question of whether to meet in full, en banc, as it is known in legal circles, to review the panel's 2-1 decision in the McDonald case. The effect was, as had been the effect of the 3-3 split on the same question in 1976, to allow the panel majority's decision to stand. An exultant Bernie Siegel told the press that the vote was a long-awaited Christmas present for Dr. McDonald. Ted Gunderson released a copy of Stokely's confession to a Fayetteville, North Carolina newspaper and told Los Angeles reporters that she gave names of everybody involved and gave details of the crime. It was a sex, drug, satanic cult and a Manson-type murder. Gunderson added that Stokely's group had called itself the Black Cult and, still active, had committed at least 13 murders altogether. On the East Coast, Freddie Kassab repeated, "If the courts won't administer justice, I will, in no uncertain terms. I'll sit just long enough to see what the Supreme Court does. There's no way that I'm going to let him walk around loose." Shortly before Christmas, McDonald made a tape and sent it to me. "I'm sitting out on the dock right now," he said, "having a beer, trying to tread that fine line between sitting inside a dark room and having some wine and really getting down in the dumps, or sitting out in the sun, Southern California style, and feeling good about life. I don't feel good about life, but I feel a little better than I did a couple of days ago. So I'm sitting in the sun, and you're hearing ducks in the background. To bring you up to date, Candy and I are doing fine. We've come through, I think, a fairly rough period. I would say basically the problem has been that we're at very different stages. You know, I'm 37 and fighting for a new place in the sun and an income and reacceptance into life or whatever, and Candy at 24, bursting forth in the bloom of almost unspoiled youth and beauty. We're just at very different points and places, and I'm having a hard time either making her understand it or whatever. We're not meshing gears real well. But lately, it's starting to come around, I guess because I'm starting to feel a little better. She has her own apartment, and that relieved a whole lot of tension and pressure that was unspoken between us, because I have no desire to play the father or the protector right now. I'm just doing too many things and sorting out too many of the past years in my head to totally help her, you know, grow up right now. Let's see. Bringing you up to date on my activities, as incongruous as this sounds and now seems to me, the Policemen's Benevolent Association of Long Beach has been hounding me to attend all their annual things, which occur right around Christmas. So unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess I should say, as the case may be, over the past 4 weeks, I've been to 3 functions. One was at the bar owned by Dennis Hera, the lineman for the Rams, which is the big hit in Long Beach now. It's called Legends. And, Big Dennis, all 6'6" and 260 pounds of him, parades around, eyeing the 20-year-old blondes who sneak in without proof, and the Benevolent Association had a cocktail party there, and I went to it. It was extremely uncomfortable. The only thing that really happened of import was that the assistant director for the Long Beach Grand Prix assured me that he wants me back as medical director for next year's race. I've been medical director for the Grand Prix almost since its inception. I think the second year I took it over, and we've done well by them, and they have done well by us with top-flight medical care. Then Candy and I went to the Christmas party for the Honorary Policemen's Association, and there were 5 lifetime members, lifetime honorary members, in the history of the association, me being number 1 for saving a policeman's life who was shot in the stomach and was being mistreated at another hospital. And then Whitey Littlefield, who was Frank Sinatra's manager and owner of the beer distributorship for this area, Somerset Distributors, is number 2, and there are 3 other businessmen in town who have become 3, 4, and 5, so there was a big dinner in our honor. We had another. Whitey Littlefield, the same guy I just mentioned, has a birthday party each year. His birthday's at Christmas, but he holds it early in December, and so we've been to these police parties, so I'm in this kind of strange frame of mind, just coming out of Terminal Island and having a very different feeling about police in general, but still being wined and dined by the Honorary and Policeman Benevolent Association group of people, and, so I'm sort of masking some feelings as I'm spending some somewhat social evenings doing these things. I trust you can hear the medevac in the background. That's a National Guard helicopter going overhead. Let's see. "Hey, babe!" Tape recorder clicks off. "Excuse the interruption. I just had a pretty young thing stop by to say hello. God, she looked great, too. She's jogging from Cal State past my house, which is a pretty good jog. She's on about a 7-mile run." In March of 1981, the Justice Department filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, asking the Fourth Circuit speedy trial ruling be reviewed. Jeffrey McDonald continued to report to his parole officer once a week. except for one trip to Las Vegas, where he served as medical director for the Caesars Palace Grand Prix auto race, he remained confined to the state of California under the terms of his bail. He sent me a tape in May. A reasonably good friend of mine, Mike Jenkins, was killed recently, and I'd been sort of shoring up Pat Kinder, my former head nurse, who was going with him. They were just getting ready to buy a house in Palos Verdes. He's this ex-Green Beret CIA type, a little paranoid. As a matter of fact, and it's in kind of a strange way, we were getting closer together over a couple of issues. One was helping Ted Gunderson out with a rapid deployment force, an anti-terrorist force for an Arab government in which we're providing medical support. And Mike Jenkins was, you know, in on this with me. I finished a report for Ted Gunderson recently, which, A, was fun to do, and, B, it may mean a trip to the Middle East when I'm off bail, and, C, it was interesting kind of work for me, the anti-terrorist force based on field medicine. So, anyway, we were working together on that. And also about 3 weeks before his death, I'd gotten this call in the middle of the night from Pat Kinder that he had been arrested and, laugh, what should she do about it? And basically, to make a long story short, he was leaving her house early one morning, and there was a police unit nearby, and there was... The story diverges here. He says there was a backfire, and the police say they heard a gunshot. So they stopped his van, and of course, he always carries a couple of guns, one in the small of his back and one in his sock. He's a little paranoid, like I say. He's an ex-CIA guy for a long time, still identified himself with his code number. Anyway, so they found these guns on him, which were not, clearly, not authorized, and so he was arrested, and we had to bail him out of jail in the middle of the night, and Pat Kinder didn't know how to go about doing it, so she called me, and we're old friends anyway, and we usually help each other out at times of crisis, but, laugh, we eventually got him a lawyer and got the $500, whatever the heck it was, together, and about 8 o'clock that morning, he was bailed out. In any case, he was killed. He was filming he's a free faller, parachuter, and kind of heavy duty. He probably has, I don't know, 6,000-7,000 jumps. And his business is photography. And he's kind of a famous guy for his free fall photography. He does a lot of advertising for TV and for the media in which, you know, the shots are of either of other free fallers or some product or something, but involving parachuting. And so he makes his money as a photographer, basically involving parachute work. In any case, he was making a commercial over a lake up near Big Bear, and the production crew wanted him to film it over the land, and he said no, over the water. So he goes out of the plane, and his first chute doesn't open. So he cuts it away, takes his knife out of the calf holster that he always carries a knife in just for that reason, and he cut away the shrouds on his main chute, which were all tangled, and he let it go free. And then he opened his reserve, and the reserve didn't fully deploy, and he mildly crashed and burned into the lake. The really strange thing is, and the even more sad part of the story is that he, was apparently okay after he hit the water. The people on the shore had binoculars, and they saw him hit the water, and they saw him actually stand up, apparently on a sandbar, and they saw him cutting his parachute free. And then they turned their back on him and went to get in a rowboat and row out to him, and when they next turned around, he was missing. And they found him out in the lake, drowned. Apparently, he stepped off the sandbar trying to walk to shore, and he had 2 movie cameras on his helmet, and they weighed about 40 pounds. And apparently, he got underwater and couldn't get above the water again once his helmet filled with water, and he drowned. The clincher in it, the saddest of all, is that Pat had just taken off to go skiing up in Mammoth, and when she got back, there were messages on her answering service to please not to call anyone, but to call this guy who was her best friend, actually not her best friend, but his best friend, who was a guy who's now a vice president of a bank out here, and he's kind of a famous guy in the Green Berets. He's called Captain Hook. He's a captain in the Green Berets, and in Vietnam got his arm blown off, and he has one of these metal hooks. And he's a free faller also, and he's a good friend of Jenkins and myself. And he's one of the guys who helped organize this relief mission to Nicaragua and Guatemala that we were doing in the middle 70s. There was a bunch of ex-Green Berets who had gotten together and gotten this relief mission with about 28,000 or 50,000 pounds of medical supplies and dried foods and stuff. And then we were stopped by the CIA because the pilot of our plane was on the outs with the CIA because of some operations in Bangladesh. Anyway, it gets very complicated. But the point was, Captain Hook had left a message on Pat's answering service not to call anyone, but to call him. And she was replaying the rest of her messages, and among those other messages was a call from Mike, saying, "Don't go skiing, please call me." And of course, Pat immediately felt that she was the cause of his death, and had she made the call, that maybe he wouldn't be dead today, etc., etc. So anyway, I had to sort of support her through this and ended up taking her to the funeral, which was an incredibly moving experience. There was this, little chapel on the hillside out 15 miles from here, inland, and it was filled with all these, I would say it was packed to the brim with, you know, some couples and some young people and some old people and some families. But the majority, like 70% of the people there, were these strange assortment of CIA and Green Beret and undercover operatives, and a lot of guys who'd been in the service together, and a lot of them kind of strange, and a lot of legends attached to some of these guys, and there wasn't a dry eye in the place. Mike is a fabulous person, was a fabulous person, one of these guys who really touched you just by knowing him. He was a high-impact person, without any question, no pun intended. He then provided an update on his social life, saying he wasn't really seeing Candy anymore, but was interested in someone else. On May 26, 1981, the Supreme Court announced that it would accept the McDonald case for review, thereby denying him, at least temporarily, total and permanent freedom. On July 30th, Helena Stokely wrote Ted Gunderson a letter in which she said, "It is my opinion that in the preceding months I have been used as a pawn for your convenience and suitability. I also feel that I was coerced into signing a so-called confession and that I was exploited by means of false hopes and empty promises. Never have I seen a bigger mockery made of justice or such a shambles made of an investigation. When I finally agreed to cooperate with you, I gave you as conclusive a review of the events of the night in question as I could. You, in turn, misconstrued and distorted all statements I made to you to be used against me at your convenience." In November, the Princeton Alumni Weekly reported in its notes on the class of 65, "Sandra O'Connor began her term as a Supreme Court Justice with two pending cases of special interest to us. The first is the university's appeal in the U.S. Labor Party case involving Princeton's right to control campus access. The second is the case against Jeff McDonald, in which a lower appeals court overturned his 1979 conviction because it said he had been denied the right to a speedy trial. Let's hope for good news on both." On December 8th, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments. Jeffrey McDonald flew to Washington for the occasion and told reporters, "I've been in this fight since I was 26. The Vietnam War has come and gone, and the government is still pursuing me. I've spent all of my emotions and most of my money fighting this. It's been a 12-year struggle. I have no feelings anymore. Brian Murtaugh wants to put me in prison, despite the evidence. He is a berserk person being paid with tax money to do this to me. I am the victim of a middle-level bureaucrat run amok. That gnaws at your innards. I have been told 4 or 5 times it was all over. I can't keep bearing this weight." He then returned to California and purchased a $200,000 condominium at the Mammoth Mountain Ski Resort and traded in his Citroen Maserati for a Jaguar. He was, by now, dating a 20-year-old student from Long Beach State University. Her name was Randy D. Marquith, and she was, McDonald said, "the first person I felt great with since Colette." He had met her through her work as a volunteer at St. Mary's Hospital. "It was the day after I'd gone to his lecture on trauma," she told a Long Beach newspaper. "I met him in the hall and said, 'Hi, Dr. McDonald.' He smiled and said, 'Hi, Randy.' And I couldn't believe it. He knew my name. My heart dropped. My face felt red and hot, and I stumbled around for words. I probably said something dumb. Despite the difference in age and background, and despite the uncertain future McDonald faced, romance bloomed quickly. It was strange, Randy D. said. From the very beginning, the sparks we felt. We are both vivacious, energetic people. We both love outdoors and children and music and just being together. We're so in love, so excited and happy with each other. In March, they decided to get married. I dragged him into the drugstore and bought some bride's magazines, and he helped me pick out a dress. Then we made out our guest list. I'd call out a name from his address book, and he'd say, yes or no, whatever. We decided on a big wedding in Newport Beach, and we decided on children, two of them. Jeffrey loves children. On the evening of March 24, 1982, McDonald invited 24 friends to his Huntington Beach condominium. Randy D. Markwith was already there. Champagne was served in crystal goblets, and then four limousines pulled up to the door. Jeff and Randy got into the first limousine, a white one. They pulled out of the Mariner Drive complex and turned left on the Pacific Coast Highway, heading south toward Balboa Island and their favorite restaurant, where dinner was to be served to the entire group. It was a perfectly lovely evening in every way. Just before the first course was served, Jeff stood to make a brief speech. He said that despite the fact that there remained some clouds on the horizon, he and Randy had decided to say yes to each other, to say yes to love, to say yes to life. Then he formally announced their engagement. The food, he reported later, was superb. A choice of entrees, filet mignon, stuffed baby salmon, or veal. The only odd part, he said, was his mother. She would not eat. She did not even sample her main course. Having heard the engagement announcement, she just sat there throughout the dinner, staring down at her plate, saying nothing. On March 31, 1982, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, 6-3, that Jeffrey McDonald's constitutional right to a speedy trial had not been violated. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice Warren Burger stated, "The Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial is designed to minimize the possibility of lengthy incarceration prior to trial, impairment of liberty imposed on an accused while released on bail, and to shorten the disruption of life caused by arrest and the presence of unresolved criminal charges." In the opinion of the court, the period from 1972 to 1974 could not be counted in any consideration of a speedy trial claim, because throughout that time, there were no criminal charges outstanding against McDonald, the Army having dismissed those which had originally been filed. Inevitably, Berger wrote, there were undesirable consequences flowing from the initial accusation by the Army and the continuing investigation after the Army charges were dismissed. Indeed, even had there been no charges lodged by the Army, the ongoing comprehensive investigation would have subjected McDonald to stress and other adverse consequences. However, once the charges instituted by the Army were dismissed, McDonald was legally and constitutionally in the same posture as though no charges had been made. He was free to go about his affairs, to practice his profession, and to continue with his life. In a footnote, Berger added, "There is nothing to suggest that the Justice Department acted in bad faith in not securing an indictment until January 1975. Plainly, the indictment of an accused, perhaps even more so, the indictment of a physician, for the heinous and brutal murder of his pregnant wife and two small children, is not a matter to be hastily arrived at, either by the prosecutorial authorities or by a grand jury. The devastating consequences to an accused person from the very fact of such an indictment is a matter which responsible prosecutors must weigh carefully. The care obviously given the matter by the Justice Department is certainly not any indication of bad faith or deliberate delay." In a separate footnote, Berger added, "Our analysis of the speedy trial claim is not influenced by consideration of the evidentiary basis of the jury verdict. The jury that heard all of the witnesses and saw the evidence unanimously decided the respondent murdered his wife and children. Berger was joined in his opinion by Justices White, Powell, Rehnquist, and O'Connor. Justice Stevens filed a separate, concurring opinion, in which he disagreed with Berger's view that McDonald's speedy trial rights had been in suspension between the Army's dismissal of charges in 1970 and the return of the indictment in 1975. He found, however, that because the murders constituted such a serious offense, the government was entitled to proceed cautiously and deliberately before making a final decision to prosecute. Writing a dissent in which he was joined by Justices Brennan and Blackmun, Thurgood Marshall found that the majority opinion was not justified by the language of the Speedy Trial Clause or the teachings of our cases, and it is hopelessly at odds with any sensible understanding of speedy trial policies. Marshall continued, "The majority's analysis is simple. The Speedy Trial Clause offers absolutely no protection of a criminal defendant during the period that a charge is not technically pending. But simplicity has its price. The price, in this case, is disrespect for the language of the clause, important precedents of this court, and speedy trial policies. Nothing in the language suggests that a defendant must be continually under indictment in order to obtain the benefits of the speedy trial right. Rather, a natural reading of the language, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial, is that the Speedy Trial Clause continues to protect one who has been accused of a crime until the government has completed its attempts to try him for that crime." In the McDonald case, Marshall wrote, he found the question of whether the delay had violated McDonald's speedy trial right to be close. "Most difficult to evaluate," he said, "was the question of prejudice." But he noted that proof of actual prejudice to the defense at trial is not necessary. The mere potential for prejudice would suffice. In McDonald's case, Marshall wrote, the record was clear that the delay had caused substantial prejudice, including continuing anxiety, intrusive publicity, legal expense, and disruption of a new civilian career. And he added that the proof of actual prejudice at trial, although somewhat speculative, was suggested by the possibility that Stokely's trial testimony would have been less confused and more helpful to McDonald at an earlier date. Marshall agreed that the government's interest in reaching an informed decision whether to prosecute is certainly legitimate, but said vague, unexplained references to internal disagreement about prosecution cannot justify more than 2 years of indecision. It was, however, once again, the majority opinion which had the force of law, and within an hour of its announcement, Judge Franklin T. Dupree, Jr. had signed an order revoking McDonald's bail, and federal agents descended upon 16052 Mariner Drive and took him away in handcuffs, as a stunned and tearful Randy D. Markwith stood watching. He entered the back seat not of a long white limousine, as he had just 1 week earlier, but of a plain gray sedan. And this time, coming out of the Mariner Drive condominium complex, the car turned not left down the Pacific Coast Highway toward Balboa Island, but right toward the Federal Correctional Institution at Terminal Island, from the confines of which Jeffrey McDonald had enjoyed more than 18 months of freedom. During the process of arrest, agents discovered a .44 Magnum revolver, the most powerful handgun manufactured in the United States, and a box of ammunition in a nightstand next to his bed. The possession of such a weapon was a violation of the terms of McDonald's bail, but insofar as he was once again serving 3 consecutive life sentences for murder, the point was moot. Perhaps, however, Freddie Kassab's repeated threats to administer justice personally had not fallen upon entirely deaf ears. During his first week back in prison, McDonald wrote me to say that he'd read in the Los Angeles Times that Robert Redford was looking for new material, and he suggested that Redford be approached about the possibility of playing the role of McDonald in a movie version of the story. In June, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments on McDonald's remaining points of appeal. On July 12th, he wrote to say that, "Despite a chipped toe and sprained ankle, football, I won the July 4th 3-mile run here, ran a great tactical race, and dogged this 22-year-old Indian for 17 laps, 2 steps behind him, burst past him with 50 yards to go, won 6 Cokes and a trophy. Time, 19 minutes, 51 seconds. 4 days later, he wrote to say that he had just read the transcripts of the oral arguments made in Richmond in June. "No question, we've won. Only question is if there will be a new trial or complete dismissal." On August 16th, however, the same 3-judge panel that had ruled in McDonald's favor on the speedy trial issue found unanimously that the trial had been error-free and that there was ample warrant for the verdict. Even Justice Murnahan concurred, albeit not without substantial misgiving, particularly in regard to Judge Dupree's ruling on the Stokely witnesses. "My view," he wrote, "is that the testimony should have been admitted. If such evidence was not persuasive, which is what the government essentially contends in saying that it was untrustworthy, the jury would not have been misled by it." In the end, however, Murnahan stated that it would undermine the concept of trial court discretion, were a courts of appeal to label as abuse of discretion any action by a district court with which the appellate court disagrees. Murnahan concluded his separate but concurring opinion with the statement, "The case provokes a strong uneasiness in me. The crimes were base and horrid, and whoever committed them richly deserves severe punishment. The evidence was sufficient to sustain the findings of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Still, the way in which a finding of guilt is reached is, in our enduring system of law, at least as important as the finding of guilt itself. I believe McDonald would have had a fairer trial if the Stokely-related testimony had been admitted." Randy D. Marquith remained in residence at 16052 Mariner Drive. In the return address on mail she sent out, she signed herself as Mrs. Randy McDonald. On August 31st, she sent me a note which said, "I've enclosed some letters that I've written to Jeff, and vice versa. Jeff asked me to send you some so you could better understand the intense and very beautiful love that Jeff and I share. I've also enclosed a contract which was drawn up by the two of us and worded by Jeff. It is very meaningful to both of us, and it is something that we read often." In an 11-page letter within 6 days after his appeal for a new trial had been unanimously rejected in Richmond, McDonald had said to his fiancée, "I'm strong and logical and have taken stock in our resources, and I feel and believe and know that we, will win. I don't know how soon, how, why, anymore, but I will win. I will be free. How vindicated I'll be, I don't know. That depends on so many things. It depends on PR, the new evidence, the strength of my lawyers, investigators, me. It depends on chance, a new witness being found, luck, friends, a pardon. Vindication can come in many ways. It may be sudden, full, complete. It may be partial in the courts or through PR or through the book or movie. It may be through a pardon. I don't know. Can't tell. But I will win. I will be out. I will fight until that is so." The contract was dated April 12, 1982, which meant that it had been composed less than 2 weeks after McDonald's return to prison. In Jeffrey McDonald's handwriting, the same hand that had written of Escatrol 12 years earlier, the same hand which a jury believed had written the word pig in Colette's blood on the headboard of the bed they had shared, the contract said, "We, the undersigned, are deeply in love and have agreed to become man and wife forever. We both fully intend for this complete union to occur as soon as it is possible to do so. We both fully intend to have 2 children within our first several years together in order that our children can enjoy our intense love and benefit therefrom as much as possible. In addition to the above, the undersigned have fully discussed and mutually agree upon another series of binding promises to each other. These promises are part of, but not the total sum of, our complete love for each other. These promises were made on or about our fabulous weekend in Palm Springs, during which Jeffrey Robert McDonald proposed to and was accepted by Randy D., the date of which began on Saturday, March 20th, in the year of our Lord, 1982. The engagement followed as soon as was humanly possible, namely on March 24th, 1982, in a ceremony and gathering of mutual friends that, by general consensus, was a party of all-time grace, elegance, and beauty. The series of binding promises to each other made on that fabulous weekend leading to the engagement party consist of 1. Neither party, namely JRM or RDM, will ever go to bed and sleep angry at the partner. Each partner promises to clear the problem prior to sleep, even to the extent of awakening the other partner and talking through the night to accomplish the goal of renewing the full feelings of love and respect. 2. Each partner will always make every effort to be home every night with his, her, loved partner, friend, lover, spouse. In the unfortunate event that either partner cannot be home, every effort will be made to call the other partner and say, "I love you." 3. Each partner agrees fully that if one partner asks a question, a truthful and full answer will be given by the other partner. Each partner agrees that the love shared is so great and so intense that it can overcome any problems that may arise by a full and truthful answer. 4. Each partner in this lifelong contract of love and fidelity agrees that the single most important thing and person in the world is their respective partner. 5. Furthermore, each loving partner agrees that our children are part of our love and will share in our love and happiness and growth, and that our loved children are a major part of our universe and will assume a position of importance in our family superseded only by our incredible love for each other, a love so great that it is awesome to both us and observers. The children, they had decided, were both going to be boys. Following the decision of the appeals court, Jeffrey McDonald was transferred from Terminal Island to the higher security federal prison at Lompoc, California. One day, not long afterward, Randy D. Marquith, having become a stewardess for Pacific Southwest Airlines, paid him a visit to inform him that the engagement was off. She moved out of 16052 Mariner Drive. McDonald's mother began to clear his personal belongings from the apartment in order that it might be sold. The condominium at Mammoth Mountain was also put up for sale, as were the recovery room and the Jaguar. After 6 weeks at Lompoc, McDonald was transferred to the Federal Correctional Institution at Bastrop, Texas, to serve the remainder of his term. Vowing to fight on, he dismissed Bernie Siegel as chief counsel and hired a new lawyer from Santa Monica. He also hired a new private investigator from New York City. Helena Stokely, having recanted her recantation, reconfessed in front of television cameras provided by a program called Jack Anderson Confidential. From prison, McDonald urged his new lawyer to explore the possibility of gaining for him a presidential pardon. "President Reagan," he wrote, "two-pronged attack, orchestrated carefully." He suggested that Reagan could be approached either through Jack Anderson, who seemed obviously sympathetic to the cause, if not terribly well informed about the facts, or through the new governor of California, George Dukmejian, who was said to be a friend of Whitey Littlefield's, the beer distributor from Long Beach and fellow honorary member of the Long Beach Police Officers Association. From Bastrop in central Texas, about 30 miles east of Austin, he wrote his new attorney a letter, just as the attorney prepared to visit North Carolina in an attempt to familiarize himself with the case. Some thoughts on public relations. The Supreme Court should grant a new trial, but probably won't, so my only hope is a new trial based on new evidence. We'll have to get the evidence, package it, and force a new trial. We'll have to marshal public opinion to do that, I think, and we have to expend good energy that way. I'm writing this letter to tell you what you already know, and it doesn't require an answer, but I wanted to say it. I was innocent in 1970, and I'm innocent now. I spent 7 months in a room in 1970 and a year in prison in 1979 to 80, and now 7 months more in prison. I'm looking at the rest of my life here, among functional illiterates and vicious people who spend 85% of their time bragging about their crimes. The grotesque monster of the case has been on my back for so long, I'm not sure what I'd be like without this incredible pressure 24 hours a day. But I would like to find out. The insanity of being here, of being saddled with a guilty verdict on these horrendous crimes against my family and myself, of facing the rest of my life behind razor wire, being told to make my bed by thugs with an IQ approaching 60, of watching my mom aging now incredibly quick and becoming uncertain in her thought and actions. It is almost too much to take. I go over the ifs of my case, and I can't sleep for 2 nights each time. I can afford no more if-onlys. I need some hope, some new evidence, and a vindication. I have to leave this system, this case, these 12 and a half years, and return to a real life. I'd like to see my mom smile again. I'd like to treat patients again. I'd even like a family. That was Randy's gift to me. She got me over that hurdle. I'm hoping you come back from North Carolina with key new evidence. If not, at least a determination, if not a religious fervor, to plunge headlong and 100% into the case, to work day and night, to find the means to overturn this monster I've been saddled with. The weeks and months keep slipping by. I'm now 39 and have lots of anger to dissipate as I try to resume a life. Remember, this all started when I was 26. I'm sitting here in Texas, in a strange and alien land, in an environment that is 500 fools locked up by 300 borderline retards, on a junior college campus, but treated like junior high schoolers, with our campus surrounded by double fences topped with razor wire and barbed wire, all on closed-circuit TV. It is really bizarre. I need to walk out of here, vindicated, able to hold my head up, able to care for myself and my family. I need that fairly soon. Lastly, let me say that for 12 years, I let the lawyers do it. I paid my way, dearly at times, but I concentrated on my professional career, myself, forgetting February 17, 1970, and tried to live a normal life. That is all gone, and they are saying, forever. My fight now is truly for my life, as it was that night in 1970. Only this death will take 30 to 40 years. I don't want or deserve this. I need to be vindicated. I need to walk out of here, back to life. I would like to smell the flowers again, and I should. On Monday, January 10th, 1983, the Supreme Court, without comment, denied McDonald's request that it review the Fourth Circuit's rejection of McDonald's claim that he had not received a fair trial. This brought to an end, after 12 years, 10 months, and 24 days, the legal phase of the Jeffrey McDonald case. 3 days later, on the afternoon of Thursday, January 13th, the body of Helena Stokely was found on a couch in an apartment she had been renting in Seneca, South Carolina. The body, found by a maintenance man who had come to the apartment to install weather stripping, was in a state of decomposition which indicated that she had been dead for several days. Her 7-month-old son, the product of her marriage to Ernie Davis, who was serving a 15-year jail sentence for first-degree sexual assault at the time of her death, was found, badly dehydrated but alive, beneath a crib not far from the couch. From his Bastrop prison cell, McDonald said he found the death highly suspicious, but autopsy disclosed that Stokely had died of natural causes, pneumonia, brought on by cirrhosis of the liver, which for years had been diseased with hepatitis. The manager of the apartment complex in which she had been living said, "She told us a couple of weeks ago that she and the baby had pneumonia." The manager added, "They were going without food. She told me one time she had only peanut butter sandwiches for 5 days." From his jail cell near Greenville, South Carolina, Ernie Davis charged that his wife's death was the result, at least indirectly, of harassment by investigators employed by Jeffrey McDonald. "Helena was like a puppet," he said. "These people would pull her strings and make her do whatever they wanted. They tell her they talked to people who could place her at the murder scene and that she'd end up in jail if she didn't confess. Other times they promised to get her a part in a movie once it was all over. She was just trying to please them. They put things in her head they knew weren't true and had her repeat it in the confessions. She knew it was all lies, but she finally sold out. She said time and time again that if she didn't tell them what they wanted to hear, they'd bother her even more." Both Ted Gunderson, who was approaching literary agents with the story of how he had solved the McDonald murders, and Prince Edward Beasley, who had reached an agreement with a former Fayetteville newspaper reporter that the two of them and Stokely would share in the proceeds of a book and possible movie to be based on the proposition that the Stokely cult had been responsible for the killings, denied the charges leveled by Ernie Davis. "Every time Helena gave us statements, it was voluntary," Gunderson said. "The only time she was reluctant was when Ernie was harassing her, and still, she gave us 14 or 15 signed statements." And ignoring the autopsy findings, syndicated columnist Jack Anderson had written a January 15th column, which the Washington Post headlined, "Evidence Backs the Innocence of McDonald," in which he said, "My staff has uncovered stacks of evidence that supports the doctor's claim of innocence," without at any point specifying what the stacks consisted of. Anderson's follow-up piece was headlined, "Death of Trial Witness Looks Suspicious." In this he wrote, "Not long ago, a tragic young woman named Helena Stokely stepped out of the shadows to save a man from life in prison. She told my office a story that brought her nothing but grief and threats. Last month, she was found dead in her hideout apartment in South Carolina." The column strongly implied that members of Stokely's witchcraft cult had been responsible for her death, but did not ever suggest how such a cult might use pneumonia and cirrhosis to silence a renegade member. Encouraged by such evidence of continued support and, as he told a Long Beach newspaper reporter, by more than 6,500 letters, all about a dozen of them supportive, Jeffrey McDonald vowed to fight on. Dismissing Bernie Siegel as an asshole, he hired a new attorney. And, as ex-FBI agent Gunderson began to give press interviews claiming that the Stokely cult was threatening his life, McDonald also employed a new team of private investigators. Gunderson told a Dallas newspaper that he had received the following deadly message, presumed to be from members of the cult: 13 red roses, 13 chrysanthemums, and a typed note that read, "Poacher in the grass. Once a cub, the lion sees shades of death and life," and that as a result, it found it necessary to flee Los Angeles and begin a life on the run. He said that by April 1983, his new attorney would be in court with an ironclad case that would prove his innocence. "We're going to have both barrels loaded," McDonald said. "We're going to have this thing in a cast-iron mold with perfect evidence." In the meantime, he said, he was keeping trim in prison by abstaining from dinner. "Too many carbohydrates," he said. Not long afterward, however, McDonald estimated that it would be midsummer at the earliest before his lawyers would be ready to proceed, despite the fact that, "We know the people who were in the house that night, and we are on the road to locating them." Later, he said no motion would be filed before fall. The people named by Stokely in 1981 were located, not by McDonald's investigators, however, but by FBI agents, and in February 1983, by a Fayetteville newspaper reporter named Steve Huddle. With the exception of Greg Mitchell, who had died in June of 1982 from liver disease, and who had been investigated and cleared by the CID in 1971 and by the FBI 10 years later, all denied any knowledge of the murders. One called Stokely's story totally insane and the craziest thing I've ever heard. Another termed it the ravings of a madwoman. These two were individuals who, like Mitchell, had been investigated and cleared of involvement, both by the CID in 1971 and by the FBI in 1981 and 1982, following the delivery of Stokely statements to the Justice Department by representatives of Jeffrey McDonald. A key figure in the Stokely confession, one she had not named in prior statements, was Alan Mazerol, who was traced to a small town in Maine. His denial of involvement was supported by Cumberland County court records, which showed he had been arrested on January 28, 1970, for possession and transportation of LSD, and had remained in jail until March 10th, thus making his presence in or near 544 Castle Drive during the early morning hours of February 17th a physical impossibility. "It's ridiculous," Mazerol said of Stokely's allegation. "She was the informer who fingered me to the narcotics agents." McDonald, however, still would not admit that it was over. "The rock won't crumble," he wrote to one admirer, and after telling me in a collect phone call from Bastrop that he was 80% certain that the Mazerol court records had been falsified by government agents in an attempt to discredit Stokely, he said, "I just believe there will be a major break in the next few months. The things we sensed were there are there. The facts will bear me out. This time, we're going to win." He also said to a Long Beach newspaper reporter who interviewed him at Bastrop early in 1983, "I have the same nightmares. I still hear Colette's voice and the sounds in the house. I still see the blood. I still wake up in a cold sweat, exhausted." As long as there is money to pay them, of course, the lawyers and private investigators will be able to keep busy for years. There will always be new witnesses, new leads, and no doubt there will be money. No small amount of it supplied by that remaining hardcore of true believers. Those who accept Jeffrey McDonald at face value, those who did not attend the trial in its entirety or at all, and who have never taken the time and trouble to read the record. Those who are still so mesmerized by the glittery surface of McDonald's personality, even though he is gaunt now with graying hair, a haggard replica of his former self, as one interviewer described him, that their allegiance remains unpolluted by fact. "He's never going to accept his guilt," Brian Murtaugh said, not long after the Supreme Court's final decision in the case. "He's never going to just sit in jail. There is a temptation to say, the end. This is it. Finished. But no, not really. The case is never going to be in a posture where he just quietly sits in jail and lets the years roll by." Chapter 5. It is over for me, though. I have reached the end. I have followed the tangled paths as far as possible, and they have led me to places where I did not ever want to be. There was a day, a very hot and humid Saturday in early August, when, in the company of two criminologists who were preparing to testify for the defense, I went inside 544 Castle Drive. I remained for 5 hours amid the mustiness, the clutter, and the dust. For the most part, it was the little things to which my attention was drawn. On the dining room floor, there was a small wooden figure, about the size of my thumb. A piece of a Fisher-Price toy. In Kristen's room, under her bed, there was a jumble of golden books and dolls and finger paintings which she had made on poster paper 9.5 years before. There was also a large rectangular hole in the floorboards where the bloody footprint of her father had been removed. Across the hall, in Kimberly's room, there was a pair of white sneakers with holes in the toes. Her bare mattress was still stained by faded blood. In the master bedroom, at the end of the hall, splinters of wood still lay on the blood-stained shag carpet, and on the windowsill stood a long-dead poinsettia, its pot wrapped in red tinfoil, A Remnant of Christmas, 1969. Colette's beige bra, which she had removed as she had changed into her pajamas on the night of Monday, February 16th, 1970.